Coming up today, will GCHQ see a reform? Words from Nick Clegg suggest it might not be the worst idea ever. Plus, trouble is brewing as a company tries to add DRM to coffee. And heard of Bro App? We're going to get all pissed off talking about whether it's a sexist app or not. All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and interesting from science and tech to coffee news and espionage blues. I'm your host, Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Olivia _ Solon.
And I'm Liat Clark.
And my microphone stand is just being moved. There we go. That was a live adjustment there. Hope you enjoyed it. I'm back, by the way. I've been away. Where was I? Mobile World Congress.
Barcelona.
That's where
Barcelona.
I was. Exhausting, that was. But the show was fun last week. My favourite thing about not being on a podcast is that I get to listen to the podcast on a plane or going through customs, which was quite nice. But for those of you who didn't hear any of last week's special episodes, it turns out that our feature, or interview rather, with the Firefox VP, Jonathan Nightingale, has been an extremely popular download. Lots of people listening to that bonus episode about the Firefox £15 smartphone. So do take a listen to that if you haven't heard that already. And obviously we had our Mobile World Congress special from Katie and I last week too, which was covering all the things we saw from Mobile World Congress. And naturally, the regular show that I wasn't on, which, despite me not being on it, is brilliant. In fact, maybe it was improved by me not being on it.
You were on it. There was a five-minute segment you talked about the highlights from Mobile World Congress, but you weren't hosting it.
That's true. I was on it. I forgot.
Is that what swayed you then?
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, we've got news to do. Nick Clegg, he's been all up in our face this week, hasn't he, Liat?
Oh, yeah.
Talking about reforming GCHQ. What's going on now? He's had a year to sort this out since the leaks.
Exactly. And he's finally digested it. And he's like, hey, guys, maybe we have a problem here.
Yeah. He swallowed the news. He's had a year to digest it.
He has basically made a speech announcing, first off, that there's going to be an independent review, finally, into how GCHQ operates, particularly in relation to its bulk data collection. This is going to be carried out by the Royal United Services Institute. But throughout the speech, what was important was basically him making a stand on, you know, this has caused an awful lot of public distrust in the government related to issues of freedom of expression and privacy. Yes, we have a framework in place in which to operate our surveillance services, but nobody is actually questioning that framework, and we need to have an independent review to assess that. So throughout the speech, I pretty much agreed with most of what he said.
He's saying what everyone else has been saying for the last few months.
Well, exactly. Everything he said was exactly what we've all been thinking. Bulk collection data is probably not totally okay. I mean, he said GCHQ, he trusts them, they're doing everything within a legal framework. He didn't, you know, contest the fact that it's legal. He just said, you know, quite logically, we need to address public outrage on this. Otherwise, you know, future governments are going to have a problem. We're going to have more and more of this data. We're going to produce exponentially more data in the coming decades. So why aren't we talking about this now?
So he'd said that, quote, the way in which governments make use of that data should be of fundamental concern to anyone who cares about liberal democracy, which is absolutely true, I think. And as we understand it, he's not arguing that GCHQ's actions are illegal, and has gone to pretty great pains to commend their work, but said that they need to be acting within the UK's surveillance framework. Is that right?
Well, what he was really talking about was saying perhaps that framework is broken, or that framework needs to be reformed. So the kind of concrete things he came out with, and this is very much actually along the model of taking its cue from what the US has done in the last few months, it was things like much more transparency, launching an annual transparency report, kind of like Google's, so that all those government requests to access data are being published, or at least, you know, as much of them as possible.
And he talked about launching surveillance.gov.uk.
Yeah, so basically one portal where all the intelligence services, all the different departments are represented for the public to digest information about them, you know, legal frameworks, reports, statistics on data they're collecting, probably these transparency reports he's talking about, so that basically it's not sucked into and subsumed into, you know, various websites and legal jargon. It's something that the public can understand and can therefore make, you know, an informed response to. And other,
but just to be a giant sayer of nay for a moment, I mean, do we trust that the data that gets put on surveillance.gov.uk would even be of any use to anyone? I mean, all the useful stuff's gonna stay hidden, you know, for interests of national security and what have you. And the stuff that is being revealed is obviously not important enough to keep secret, and that's why it's being made public. So what use is it to anyone, apart from saying, oh, hey, look, we're doing this stuff. We're trying to, we look how public we are. We're so transparent. We're like a window.
Mm. Absolutely.
I'm calling BS.
Yeah, but, I mean, I guess you can think about it in terms of like Google's transparency report every year will show you which government's increasing their requests, which government's decreasing their requests.
But why do we need to hear that from the government itself in that case? They're not going to say, look how many requests we've made for your information.
Well, they'll say, you know, we are curtailing our bug data requests. It might be that that's what they want to show.
Yeah, and I guess it's, you know, in the same way that you can do a freedom of information request, we're seeing a move towards this kind of transparency of government. And we just, you know, we have to trust the government in some cases. And if they can't do this right, you know, that will undermine this whole exercise.
That's fine. I'm being devil's advocate on purpose. And I know that this is a good move, generally speaking. But I do think that it's, although a lot of what we heard from Nick Clegg sounded quite positive, it sounded like he was echoing viewpoints that a lot of people in the public eye have been saying and commenting on this about things that need changing. That's great. It is a little bit of too little too late, yeah. But it is, while too late, it's still something, substance there. But I want to see more before we start saying, oh, finally, the government's acting in our best interest and being more honest about all this stuff.
I think that they're in a position where they can't come out and say, this is wrong, we can't operate this way.
It's their own.
Yeah, you can't say, then you're basically saying this is illegal and we have to change the law. Mm. They're beginning with, we're going to have an independent review, and that review is going to be asked, you know, what reforms should be made, whether that's relating to legislation or transparency or oversight mechanisms or whatever, things like that. So it could be that through that legislation is changed, but it would be impossible for the government now to say, yeah, this is totally wrong, we messed up here and it's all illegal.
But I can't believe it has taken 9 months in order to say anything remotely non kind of flippant about this. I mean, this is the first really comprehensive speech we've seen about this problem.
But it does take this long. I mean, I think 9 months is probably about what I would have expected if I had to guess when this would come out.
No, but to have a speech, to make any kind of out, you know, public sort of comment.
I know, but it's like, I think it's like working in a big company. I mean, we see this in even in our business, that if you're a small, nimble little startup, you can make changes on an hourly basis. When you're a massive organization, and the government is, to be fair, a massive organization, things like this take ages. I mean, look how long it takes to get a law put through the, you know, House
of Lords.
True,
but this is just talking about the changes they're going to make. It's about deciding upon the changes. And, you know, even we've had cases with like Open Rights Group and Big Brother Watch taking the government to court in October last year over this exact issue, whether or not the Regulatory Powers Act, is that how it's called?
Yeah.
Is even constitutional according to the European Court for Human Rights.
But that's another interesting point then, is that European law, but then we have close ties with the US and with the NSA and with the Obama administration about surveillance, and there are arrangements in place for not spying on each other's citizens and things like that, and that breaks down a lot. We saw that, I think, with the Yahoo webcam spying stuff a couple of weeks ago, that it was basically impossible not to accidentally spy on your own people and what have you. And so whatever reform happens in the UK and across Europe is it probably going to have to at least be supported by what the US is doing, because of the way that our sort of relationship is a diplomatic relationship is with the US. And I don't know if the US is even in a position to make any kind of changes that would support this. I mean,
well, the US has made very similar steps to this. It's almost like he's copied nothing. Well, basically they're implementing things like a body that is going to assess annual bulk data collections and whether it's a proportionate, or I don't know if they're going to take case studies and basically have independent people investigating whether or not this is okay. So to have a body that can assess that, which we don't have right now. I mean, right now we have Reaper and we have these things, but they're all closed off. They're not made public. And that's another thing, I think, the Investigatory Powers Tribunal that actually hears appeals about public bodies, where a lot of these complaints against GCHQ would have been made. They don't have any appeal system. So things like that, which Nick Clegg flagged up, which are really obvious, like blindingly obvious, why would you not have a British appeal system? Why should you have to go to the European Courts of Human Rights to say, I'm not happy with a ruling made? It's the one thing that doesn't have the same framework, you know, as everything else in this country.
Well, I resign my post as devil's advocate for the purpose of this discussion. I think we've discussed this enough. But you can read Liat's piece on wired.co.uk. If you search for Nick Clegg GCHQ, you will find our piece about the proposed reforms, and leave a comment. And obviously, if you've agreed or disagreed or have views on anything we've talked about in this segment, podcast@wired.co.uk, and we'll read them out next week. Coffee. I just swallowed some. Have you?
I've swallowed some today. Yeah.
Liat?
I did, actually.
Yeah, good.
First thing. Yeah, I know. Unusual for me.
Were you amazed at how easy the process was? How few hurdles there were for you to make that coffee? Very few hurdles. Well, that might be changing if you're a fan of coffee pods. Is that not right, Liv? Is not my incredibly convoluted segue correct and accurate down to the finest detail?
It absolutely is, Nate. We're talking coffee DRM right here.
We are. We're talking swallow rights management.
Yeah.
Coffee rights.
But yeah, it's relating to those single cup coffee machines. So, you know, those kind of affordable machines that you can have in the home or in the office, but then they have ridiculously expensive pods that you have to replace every
now and then. The Nespresso example is the best one.
Nespresso, Tassimo, yeah. Mm. But it turns out that there's a US brand called Keurig, K-E-U-R-I-G, that hates the fact that there are entrepreneurial third parties creating replacement pods that fit those machines that don't cost nearly a quarter as much as the official licensed pods. And so Treehouse Foods, which is a company that makes some of these non-branded refills, which are amazing, by the way, if you've ever invested in one of these coffee machines, it cuts down costs enormously. But this company is suing Keurig for being anti-competitive and for entering into exclusionary agreements with suppliers and distributors. So Keurig's going to all these coffee makers, all the pod makers, and saying, you're not allowed to make them for this small company that's making these non-licensed ones, or we're not going to, you know, do business with you.
I would have thought that's very competitive.
At least that's what they're alleging anyway.
So hang on, who's Keurig? Do they make the machines or the pods or something?
Yeah, so Keurig make the machines. Treehouse Foods, the company that's actually doing the suing in this case, is a company that makes the replacement pods, the non-branded ones. But in the filing, the legal filing, they alerted people to the fact that Keurig is actually working on a DRM for coffee. They're working on a new brewing machine called Keurig 2.0 that's said to contain anti-competitive lockout technology.
I can see this going down fantastically well in the consumer eye.
Yeah.
Just think of the sales pitch. You know, it's a coffee machine that only works with our proprietary expensive pods.
Yeah, exactly. You know, how it's going to work isn't it clear. They said there is interactive technology that will be able to identify whether an inserted capsule is a licensed K-cup or a generic copycat.
What happens then? Spits it out.
Well, who knows? And I'll give it a day before someone finds a workaround.
Exactly.
But Treehouse, rightly, I think, argues that this lockout technology doesn't have any consumer benefit. It eliminates choice and forces people to pay more money. But it turns out that this isn't the only coffee machine legal case. They're actually a litigious bunch, just like printer companies who have the ink cartridges and razor companies with the razor blades. And there have been, I think, 3 or 4 cases in Europe, but they've gone down the patent route rather than the antitrust route, which is the US case we're talking about. But all of the cases have been thrown out because judges have ruled that pods can't be patented unless they show themselves to be truly inventive.
Yeah.
And given that they're just little packages of coffee in a funny shape, that doesn't count as being patentable.
Good. Sudden breakthrough of common sense.
So this is going to go down the drain, guys.
Well, we don't know, actually, because if this anti-infringement technology can be, you know, deemed to be truly inventive, then they might be able to patent that in and of itself as opposed to just the machine.
I don't think this matters. I don't think this matters. Even if they do release this machine, let them. Let them waste their money and go out of business doing it, because no one's going to buy the damn machines. I mean, that's the stupid thing. There is no consumer benefit here whatsoever.
Yeah.
Thing is, if their coffee was their own and tasted amazing, then that's a great reason to just keep using their coffee.
Exactly.
If it was that good, good, why would you be seeking an alternative?
Exactly. So make better coffee rather than locking out competitor coffee.
Yeah, do it now. Apple made a surprising announcement at the Geneva Motor Show. Doesn't always make announcements at other people's events, but it has announced CarPlay, which is the new name for its iOS in the car initiative announced last year, and is essentially for vehicles what AirPlay is for houses. Vehicles that incorporate CarPlay will allow compatible iPhones to dock into a car and let drivers control the system using only voice. Now, this could include listening to voicemail, making calls, loading maps, using GPS, streaming Spotify music through car speakers or podcasts, and having Siri dictate incoming text messages and things like that. Some cars will have a CarPlay button built into the steering wheel for quick activation of Siri, which will then be the brain of the operation, translating spoken commands into actions, if you like. And also car infotainment screens, I hate that term, infotainment, but it does make sense, can have their interfaces taken over by a new CarPlay interface that looks a bit like the iPad display in a little bit of a way. So I thought this was really an announcement, because I think that cars and vehicles are sort of seen as the next big hurdle for consumer electronics developers, even chip makers. People like Qualcomm and Intel were showing off technology at Mobile World Congress that benefit cars, and we've seen in-car entertainment services with Land Rover using Tizen operating system that Intel co-develops with Samsung, and that's as an alternative to other systems being used elsewhere. And it's a whole spectrum of new technology coming out, and Apple really wants to be in this game. And I think this is quite an interesting move.
I think it is. I do feel like the whole in-car infotainment market is a bit of a mess, because everyone's been scrambling to sort of take the lead on it. The car manufacturers themselves have been doing it. All the mobile manufacturers as well have been trying to get on it. Then there are dedicated companies that only make infotainment systems. And there's a bit of a kind of a scramble to kind of dominate the car.
And they're often partnering with one brand, which completely, it's not presumably sustainable for future generations.
That's the challenge here, is that Apple's iOS and CarPlay, it's all proprietary. Even the connector that you dock the iPhone into a car is the Lightning connector, which is Apple's proprietary connection technology. And the challenge there means that if you're having to make a decision about a car purchase based on whether the car supports the phone you've already bought into, the ecosystem, is that a good thing for consumers? Is this going to be a point where you go out to buy the new, new Ford Focus? I don't know if the Focus would support this in the line, but let's pretend it does. Ford Focus, other cars are available. Do you say, oh, do you have the, oh, no, I've only got the iPhone version in sea blue, or I can give you the Android version in sea blue, or you might have to wait 2 months for a new delivery of iOS compatible Focuses. Is that a good thing?
No, can't be the future. Surely you're going to walk into your car, it's going to sense your phone, it's going to sync everything and be done.
I think it's going to be, I think it is the next battle. It's a thing to pay attention to, because Tizen is being developed by Samsung and Intel, as I mentioned earlier, and that is a proprietary system. There's the QNX stuff that BlackBerry runs that's in some cars. Obviously, we're talking about CarPlay now. There will be an Android thing down the line that is not too far behind, of course. All of these are proprietary. None of them are cross-compatible, even though maybe some of the services are. And CarPlay, for example, has support for Apple apps to begin with. So if you want to use maps and GPS in this, yes, you can. You have to use Apple Maps. You can't use Google Maps yet. If you want to use streaming audio, Napster's out, but you can use Spotify because Apple has got a deal with Spotify to bake the support in, at least initially. Developers, I think, down the line will be able to add support for CarPlay in their apps once iOS 7.1 comes out, we're expecting in the not-too-distant future. And some of these cars will go on sale from the likes of, I think some manufacturers have announced support already. Volvo, I think Mercedes-Benz, Ferrari are going to support it in new models this year, and then hopefully down the line it'll be a little easier to support. But it's something to be aware of, I think, that your car may have, made for iPhone printed on the side, and that might annoy you if you're an Android devotee.
You think this is just going to be for very nice cars where you walk in and you pick your leather and your shade of leather and you pick your dock. It's not for the normal cars that I will drive. I learn to drive.
I think car manufacturers will have to support cross-compatibility, even if it means shipping little docking adapters with the seat covers. I don't know. We'll find out. Let us know what you think. podcast@wired.co.uk.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. You'll be supporting Nate, Olivia, Liat, and the rest of the Wired.co.uk podcast team, and you get a free book in return. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
Welcome back, and for our next segment, our discussion segment, it's WWWTF.
What the?
Now, we alluded to Bro App in the intro, which, according to a headline by Liat, writing angrily, I think, is the latest sexist app to troll the internet. So what's going on? What is, top line, Bro App?
Bro App is for all the men out there that would like to outsource their good boyfriend behaviour to their phones so that they don't have to basically tend to their women and can spend more time with their bros. Basically constitutes pre-written messages that the phone has pre-written for you that you can program to send out to your girlfriend throughout the day. Basically, it's for very lazy people, but the creators are saying it is to ignite normal conversation in relationships, and it's a good thing because it increases happiness of both the male and the female partner.
Curious here, the other day my gran called, but I don't read too much into where I'm going with this, but I couldn't answer the call, so I said swipe to dismiss, and there's an auto message response, and I said, tapped on it, and he said, sorry, can't talk now, call you later. Mm. There's nothing wrong with that.
I know.
What's wrong with this?
I never send them because I hate sending them. But yes, what's wrong with this is probably simply the fact that they have marketed it purposefully to be massively sexist. It's all about basically having to, you know, fob off your girlfriend, not actually having to put in the time and effort. It's something most people would think is ridiculous, and they are arguing that this is good for your relationship. But I think more than that, it's kind of seems to be a trend for these types of things coming out. I know Liv wrote a piece on carrot dating, which was kind of purposefully antagonistic about...
It was bribe your way to a date was the strapline, I think. So
yeah.
Men, well, it was supposed to be gender neutral, but the pictures were all men offering up bribes to women to get them to go on dates.
Yes.
But purposefully inflammatory. And I think that's a strategy that a lot of apps and dating sites seem to be taking now to get a bit of attention when they launch.
Absolutely.
And is that what this is? I mean, yeah, automated texts and time saving. And, you know, maybe if you're a bit awkward, maybe there's some text here that might sort of spurn you into thinking about a nicer thing to say. Is that a bad thing?
Well,
is that what this is?
It would be if it was for men and women. If it was just time saving, schedule your tweets for your other half, you know, because you can't. You know, you want to care about them, but you don't have the time to put it in. But all the wording, I think Liat spoke to the founder of it.
James.
And he was saying things like, oh, well, just some men have really high pressure jobs, so they're super busy and they just don't have the time. And the kind of connotation being that women are just sitting waiting to hear back from them.
Yeah, he was very purposeful throughout. And it was, you know, people that say, you know, why don't you just think of a message and send it? Obviously haven't suffered through a busy job and all this type of thing. But then he started arguing that women have actually been asking for this as well, and that it's all aimed at bettering your relationship.
Hang on, wait. So women have been asking for the ability to text men automatically, or have been asking for the ability for their boyfriends to outsource their romance?
A version for women, which basically this could be used either way anyway. But the fact is that app also has features like basically how to deceive your girlfriend, and it has a system where you put in a passcode, and if someone puts in the wrong passcode, a deceptive screen pops up so that they don't know what it actually is. So the whole thing, I mean, I think is designed to annoy. But I just wonder, are people simply marketing these things because they think it's a solid business plan to make a bit of ruckus, and then, you know, on a lame app which basically has no inventive functionality whatsoever.
This to me seems like a misfire of what is essentially a novelty app. Is about as much credit as I can give it.
Yeah.
Because it's not a useful tool. It's not something I would want to use. I could see why. I could see the fun in, if it was a free app, downloading it from an app store and using it for a day. And then when you get home and you see your girlfriend, you're like, haha, a bit of fun today, but I didn't send any of those messages. And you believe me? Did you believe me? And they say, oh, actually, I thought it was a bit weird, but I wasn't 100% sure. And you're like, ah, that's fun. More wine, dear. And just treating it as a bit of a laugh for a day. Like that, I don't see any major harm in, to be honest, if it's just a bit of a joke.
Yeah.
It's the way that they were describing it to you. And I think before they even knew you were a journalist, that came across as being a bit more, I don't say meaningful, but the intentions were a bit more legitimate than just, you know, here's a fun way of having fun with a partner for a day.
It was purposefully all the way through, you know, women are more needy. I think he said that before I told him I was a journalist. He was saying basically women need more tending to. This is why we've created this. And then proceeded to kind of probably up the ante on the sexism. But the fact is that it's not free. And according to him, it's been downloaded one every minute. So people are actually paying for this, like a couple quid. Is this because we actually do want to outsource our, you know, humanity, which is, I wrote about another thing called Predictables last week, which is a proof of, you know, a kind of conceptual piece designed to spark debate, but it was all about scraping your social media and then prompting you with things like, buy your girlfriend some flowers, she's about to be sad. And I just wonder, is this a sad route for the future of humanity, or is this a warning? This is, in a relationship, it's never going to be a good idea to pre-program your communication.
Well, if a woman in that situation did respond well to the pre-programmed communication, perhaps they are more interested in the app than they are in the human.
Yeah, well, exactly. If it was a great AI app that she wanted to have a relationship with, then that's interesting.
But it's not bro app.
But it's not the bro behind it.
I think predictive text could work here. So it looks like you're trying to be romantic, you know.
And yeah,
so
how about this?
You have written sexy time in the bathtub, honey bunch. Would you rather say a nice romantic bathe? Yeah. Well, we wanted to discuss this generally, and let us know what you think to the idea of predicting your romantic messages to loved ones. Podcast at wired.co.uk. In fact, why not automatically try and send us a romantic message, and we'll read it out next week and see if it works on any of us. So one last quick thing we wanted to get to before we get some excellent feedback from you guys this week is that Microsoft's ex-CEO, Steve Ballmer, has said that Microsoft is a, quote, 2.5-trick pony. Liv wrote briefly about this. Liv, what did he think Microsoft's 2.5 tricks are?
Right. He did, just before I say which they are, he did say these tricks aren't just like casual tricks, they're $1 billion tricks. These are things that make loads of money. But he said inventing the modern PC with Windows and Office was the first trick.
Trick one, okay.
Second trick, which I thought was a bit of a curveball, was bringing microprocessor tech to the data center.
Okay, that's trick two. What's half a trick?
And the half trick, he said, was Xbox.
Huh, okay.
And this was in response to a question about Microsoft's failure to nail the mobile problem. And he was saying, well, actually, you know, we didn't get that right, but we've got loads of other things right. And most companies only get one thing right, if at all, most tech companies fail. So they've got 2.5 tricks. So he thought he was quite proud of that.
I mean, he had also said that most companies fail and they are zero trick companies, and successful companies are often one trick ponies where they do one thing really, really well for a while. And he was sort of saying over the last, you know, 30 years, Microsoft's been this 2.5-trick pony because they're worth so much money. But we wanted to put it out there and think, you know, would you agree with these tricks, and what else, what other tricks do you think Microsoft would have? You know, my one out there would probably be sort of an extension of trick one, but a lot of that Windows stuff has been about, you know, corporate office space. But actually, the reliance on things like Outlook and having all company infrastructure, calendaring, scheduling, everything like that for so long being tied to one server application, effectively Outlook, to me is a massive trick, because that's not just about getting people to use Windows and using a PC. That's getting entire businesses to rely on Microsoft for its connectivity. And that sort of is an ecosystem that's been very hard for anyone to break up until the last few years. Yeah. That would be a third trick. And we were curious, podcast at wired.co.uk, to suggest what you think Microsoft's other tricks might have been, or indeed what you think other companies' tricks might have been. Pick a favorite company. What has been their trick? How many ponies have they ridden, if that's a thing. And with that, we want to move into some feedback. Now, we've had, we're getting a lot more feedback these days, I think because we keep talking about it so much. And naturally, we've had someone else writing in about Dogecoin. This is the last week we're going to say anything about Dogecoin, the pronunciation thereof. But before that, we wanted to mention something that Alexander Gold had written in. And he says, "Hi all, I just listened to your latest podcast hosted by Olivia, where you discuss the NHS patient data saga." This is going back to the care.data stuff that we've been covering a lot recently. "What I fail to understand is the real concern for such data falling into the hands of insurance companies, hoping you could clarify why this is such an issue. Ignoring what the law currently says and how this may be illegal, laws develop and need updating, I fail to see the problem. The insurance market is currently basing its premiums on trends and casework, and one could argue that it is creating premiums as a result of clever guesswork. Surely, by having the full data, it can create a fair and open market based on real information. Otherwise, is it not the case that when a patient fills out a form or does a medical, there are opportunities where the patient is deceitful, and is the insurance company that loses out when such family benefits from insurance fraud as a result of patient deceit?" Don't know if I've read that out right.
Did I read that right?
Okay. "Grateful of your views, Alexander." So, Liv, I pass this to you.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting point. And I think there are two issues with this approach to the insurance market. First of all, insurance is about hedging your bets and about kind of being in a general kind of group of people and risk kind of areas, as opposed to being, this is granular, this is your, you know, we know that you have all of these ailments and we will, you know, charge you for the treatment accordingly, because otherwise you'll just end up in a situation where you're just paying for private healthcare. You know, they'll know exactly your risk, and it's not really insurance anymore. It's just, we know exactly what treatment you need, so you're going to pay for it all. And that sort of defeats the point of insurance. The second issue is, I think, which the main issue people have with care.data is the fact that it's meant to be about using your data to improve the healthcare, to improve the NHS. And so sharing that with third parties, regardless of their intentions, is not part of that. And I think that's the critical issue. It's about the sharing the data outside of the NHS.
Hope that answers your question, Alexander. Well, last up, we wanted to get to a quick email from Henrique, who wrote in with these words Liat's about to repeat.
"I'm pretty sure Doge should be pronounced like dog, except with an O," says Henrique. "So Dog. Do you think I'm saying that right?
Dog.
Dog. Sort of like a Doge of Venice, but with a hard G, because the Doge is hardcore gangster, yo, and so on. I mean, it is a picture of a dog after all, and not a prince of a medieval city. At least not one I recognise. It can be remembered through this sentence. You can pay what you owe in coins, Dog. Because it's like O with a D at the start and a G at the end. Dog. There it is. Decided. You're welcome. Sincerely, Henrik."
I think he wants to be a rapper.
I like Henrik. I think he
Me
should
too.
Be a rapper.
I felt guilty because I said Doge all the way through that.
Yeah. You've ruined it.
No.
Just to point this out to the dozens of people who email us about their views on how this word should be pronounced, this is the last time we're ever going to talk about this topic, ever. You can write in, you can keep writing into us every week, and I know some of you will, and I'm just going to say this now, no more. We're not talking about it. We're pronouncing it Doge. Is that right?
I'm pronouncing it Doge, Liat's pronouncing it Doge, yeah. And we're not talking about it anymore.
Doge and GIF. That's what it's called. Get used to it. But do email us with anything else you want to tell us about or have us discuss. podcast@wired.co.uk. Keep things coming in. We do love to discuss them. And unless there's any other business, which there isn't, because if there was, I'd know about it already, we're going to see you in a week.
Bye.
Bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android, tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.
Clegg wants you to be a devil's advocate, Nate. It's called democracy.